It is a delight to be here, maybe not after dinner, and a long day of really rigorous, thoughtful reflection on the nature of God. And so, with all due apologies to Fred, I'm not going to pray for the Father or the Son, but especially maybe tonight that the Spirit would empower your minds, enliven your hearts, because there is no worse time to teach than right after a nice dinner. Let me pray. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, be honored in our words, and may your word come to life in our lives by the power of your Spirit. Amen. It is a delight to be here, not only because I left a blizzard behind in Boston. I was on one last flight out before the snows arrived. I would have appreciated a little warmer weather here in Kansas City, but it's better than 20 inches of snow, which is now surrounding my house, evidently, in Boston. It is good to be here, not only to get out of the snow, however, but to be with pastors, for this is where theology lives and ought to live in the life of the church. You know, a generation ago, when I was just beginning, you would have thought where the action was as a young evangelicals was the academy. I had grown up reading Francis Schaeffer and was engaged in that great battle of ideas. And a generation thought that was where the fundamental conflict was. Maybe in the long shadow of Richard Hostetter's work in the 40s that called all of us fundamentalists anti-intellectuals, we were going to show them different. And so there was this remarkable renaissance that took place in the 70s and the 80s as evangelicals entered into the halls of the academy. But I think the unforeseen consequence was that we lowered our sense of prestige that attached to the pastorate. That there was a kind of turning upside down of that sacred call for theology to live in the church. And it gained a foothold outside of the church. By God's grace, I think it's fair to say that for young evangelicals today, the action is no longer in the academy. It is in the church. And we ought to be very grateful. My very best students, they want to go into the city and they want to plant churches. They want to be where the action is. This is a remarkable change in a generation that thought of the suburbs as the safe place to do church. We recognize that there is no safe place to do church. The city, no less than the rural lands of America, is where the gospel must be faithfully lived out. But there is a sea change, and I want you just to notice that you're sitting here as the public theologians of the evangelical movement. I confess I'm not entirely at home here. I'm a member of the PCA, the Presbyterian Church in America, but partners in so many projects across this country with those of you in the E-Free. But if you were to talk to a young pastor going into the PCA, who are the great lights of the movement? A generation ago, they would have thought about those who taught in seminaries, maybe, but no longer. Right? Now the names Tim Keller, Kevin DeYoung, or the names that circulate in our circles, that's where the action is. I want to suggest tonight, I sit on the sidelines of the kinds of topics I'm going to be talking about. It's you that are on the front lines. You know that. I don't have to persuade you. In some ways, I ought to be where you are, and you ought to be where I am. The very best cultural exegesis being done today is by young church planters. Not simply young, not simply church planters. I think all pastors have become, by virtue of their calling, cultural exegetes. And what I hope to at least begin a conversation about tonight is how can we do that better? I don't think I any longer need to persuade any of you that we ought to do it. But how might we do it a little bit better? Greg reminded us that we do live increasingly aware of this post-Christian world of ours. I'm not one of those that was persuaded it was ever a Christian world, so I'm not so sure I'm persuaded by the post language, but there is a sea change that has come to pass, that those who sit in the pews no longer represent our culture, that there's something unique about that. And that's important to recognize. When the great Anglican bishop came back from India, Leslie Newbegin, in the 80s, thinking that he had been on this strange foreign mission field proclaiming the gospel for a generation, he came home to this Christian country, supposedly, Britain, and recognized it was far more pagan than anything he had ever experienced in India. And we began to think about cultural engagement in very different ways after Newbegin. We live vicariously sometimes, I think, but increasingly with a sense of crisis that pervades us, how fragile our world is. Prior to 9/11, we think of our times as nostalgic, as quite golden. Now, those of you who grew up in the post-Vietnam era probably look back upon that era as an era of crisis as well. But be that as it may, 9/11 and the Great Recession, on the list goes of those major climactic events that shake up our lives. And we live in it because we are surrounded by it daily in our media, whether it's film, whether it's the blogosphere, whether it's television. We experience that tension as a persistent fact of our lives. We tend to trivialize it because we experience it so frequently, but it nonetheless surrounds us. Last summer, I read, and I try to do this each summer, pick a couple of leisure books to read. I read The Story of the Bin Ladens by Stephen Cole. And he told the story of the Bin Laden clan over three generations. In the 1920s, they were a Bedouin tribe in Yemen, absolutely poor, wandering from place to place to eke out a very barren existence. Oil is discovered on the Arabian Peninsula in the 30s. And they happen to befriend the Saudi monarch in the 40s. This is grandfather Bin Laden. Father Bin Laden in the 50s and 60s gained, by virtue of the friendship with the monarch, all of the construction contracts in Mecca and Medina. And almost overnight, this Bedouin clan was transformed into a massively wealthy family. Wealth beyond your wildest imagination in a generation. Property without end. Planes. Women. All of it was available with easy access. But now the third generation the bin Laden generation that we know, had a different experience with the inherited wealth. And they raise the questions, as Stephen Cole so wonderfully places it, where was any room left for faith? Was piety simply the product of a bygone era? We know the disastrous results of that reflection in one of the bin Laden families, but it was a question that we ought not to have missed, and we ourselves experience it in a different way. How does this Christian faith, this ancient Christian faith, vital and vibrant across two millennia, what place does it have in our world? A world that seems almost to consider it irrelevant. We are people who live on the margins of our culture. We are not the culture makers. They live in New York City or in LA, the great universities in my town, or the halls of power in Washington. But most of us, you and I, we don't make much difference, especially those of us who have religious convictions. And so it's not unusual, we ask, even at a place like this, what place does faith have in a time like ours? Inevitably, across the 20th century, in the crisis of that conflict between faith and modernity, as many have argued, the natural cultural instinct was to turn inward, was to think more and more about yourself and less about the troubled world around you. We became fascinated with ourselves, even as the objective world became less and less sure. Nietzsche prophesied in the end of the 19th century, seeing in many ways the world that was to come, prophesied that the convalescent society wasn't far off. He said, without a notion of transcendence, the only two values left will be health and happiness. We will become all absorbed by those twin concerns, health and happiness. Boy, did he ever get it right. 20% of our GDP goes to healthcare. 20% of every dollar you earn goes to health. Now, I'm all in favor of good health. We live longer, though not as long as we suppose we should live. Most of us aren't nearly as healthy as we think we should be. And we spend an inordinate amount of time claiming our rights to be healthier than we are, because somebody should have a drug that fixes whatever the problem is that we have. But we are a culture fascinated with health and happiness, with ourselves. This is a narrative all too familiar. I'm not here to persuade you that this is an alternative vision of reality. You know it, I know it. What I want to think about then is how our faith bumps into this reality, how it engages this world of health and happiness, this world turned inward because of the tectonic shifts and the conflicts of crisis that surround us. And so thinking about it in familiar language, whether we think about it as culture and the gospel, church and the world, this is not a new topic, but it is a topic of quite urgent matter for us. We normally think of theology, that word that Fred used so eloquently this afternoon, as something reserved for people like he and I, that is done in the back rooms of strange places we call the academy. But as Fred reminded us ever so well, theology is much bigger than anything we could think or imagine. Right? Theology is not about putting God under a microscope, as an infamous New Testament scholar said back in the 40s, God is not simply another object in the world, a piece of furniture. Theology is not about studying God as if or like studying any other thing. And too often, and I don't need to persuade you again, that theology has become too often a way to distinguish us from them, they who have the bad theology and we who have the good. Or a metaphor I've used, theology like a string of pearls that we wear to show off that you've paid big bucks to go to seminary and learn big words. And as there are specialists in your congregation that you pay because they are specialists, so the congregants will pay you because you use big words. You know that theology ought not simply be a fortress, a set of pearls, a wall that divides us from them. Theology must come to life if God is God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, a transcendent creator of everything that is, that Colossians 1 text so marvelously puts it. Beyond anything that we could grasp, even if we on occasion try to lift up the veil and think about the imminent Trinity, as we must, and bump into that great mystery that we are not God. Like God, so the gospel is much thicker, deeper, richer than we have often allowed it to be. We have been a movement that has done a great job at packaging and marketing. We are a movement of great images. Think about how, and my institution does it too, so I'm not here casting stones in a glass house, I hope. Think about how much effort you put into your website at church. Because there's an appearance you want to communicate with the world around you. That's how the world communicates. And so to use the vernacular, the language of our times, that's the means to communicate. But unseen often is the emphasis it places simply on appearances. On being merely an image and not an image bearer. And so let's think about theology not simply as a pearl necklace, as a wall that divides us from them, as a set of beliefs that could be listed with 15 fundamentals. And everything else is non-essential. No, theology ought to absorb us. It ought to be like a sponge where all of life is absorbed into its great realities. It is a large epic, a drama of enormous proportions, whose story is so complex and rich and interesting, it takes 66 books to get the epic in. It's imperative, yes, that we communicate in intelligible fashion. And our movement is a movement that has done quite well at simplifying things so people get it. But the other side of the movement is that sometimes we are so good at simplifying that we miss how rich and deep and thick this gospel is. You know, the fundamentals, as historians tell us, when they were published in 1915, listed all those things that conservative Christians could agree on. There were 15 of them. It depends exactly how many, depending on who you talked with, but eventually the coalition centered on the critical issues because these were the ones that conservative Christians disagreed with liberals about. So the essential doctrines often became essential because they were essentially not liberal. Fair enough. Often doctrinal clarification comes in periods of controversy. But when the whole of the story is told simply as one episode in the controversy, inevitably the next generation is poorer. We are also a movement that has too often thought success, largely numerical success, is the fundamental criteria for the presence of the Holy Spirit. When I did that crazy thing of planting a church in 1994, not knowing a soul that would show up that first Sunday when we decided to have worship, but being supported by a host of other churches and individuals who wanted to know how many came. And every month I had to turn in those statistics, right? It was as if somehow the mission of God was determined by how many people came. Numbers are not only the language of science, they are also the language of evangelicalism. It is not the best way to think about cultural engagement. How many people have fit under our roof? For people come to church, as you know, for lots of different reasons. Many of them not so good. Sometimes it's just to be with people just like themselves. Sometimes because they can make business connections. Sometimes it's because life is a mess and they haven't got any place else to go. Thinking about how theology bumps into culture, our culture, must begin at least by rethinking what this project of theology is, and thereby also what church is. Nothing brand new. I'm not here to tell you abandon two millennia of reflection by the church, but in some ways to return to what it has been, a vision for living in the world on the basis of the map of Scripture. It's a framework. Fred used the language of a map. Knowing where we are is fundamental to understanding how the map works. But if you're in Boston, the last thing you want to do is trust your intuitions about how the roads are put together. Somebody was drunk when they designed the road system in Boston. You desperately need a map. There are four different roads in four different towns, all contiguous with each other, but none of which roads intersect, but all called by the same name. So if you live on Essex Street, it will not tell you where you live. Right? And it's not a matter of simply following Essex Street in the town of Hamilton over to the town of Wenham, followed by Beverly, and then into Salem. That's not how Essex Street goes. It's actually not Essex Street at all. Essex Street in Beverly doesn't connect with Essex Street in either of those towns. The simple point being, maps are not always self-evident. And I think the scriptures give to us a map that can seem quite strange at times, counterintuitive. If it's always predictable, it's probably not the map that God has given to us. The map that God gives is a way of thinking about the past and the present and the future. It begins at the beginning and it ends at the end. It's kind of to be expected that this map is a historical map. It takes us from some place and deposits us at another place. And the place it starts is the beginning, and the place it ends is the end. But often we treat this map as a historical map and think we can just open the pages and put our finger down. Somehow we must relearn, as we are, to read the whole canon. To think not simply of our present, but our present wrapped in this great story, this great epic, this great drama, this great narrative. I tell my students that if they understand the first three chapters in Genesis, everything else follows. You don't know that until you read the rest of the canon, though. You go to Revelation 21 and 22, John's closing story, if you will, every single one of those great metaphorical themes used in the picture of the new creation find their place in those first three chapters in Genesis. It's really remarkable. Now, reading the whole canon as a map from past to present to future is a means by which we find our own place. We are situated, at least I am, somewhere between Genesis 1 and the end of the book of Revelation. It is a macro narrative that encompasses the micro-narrative called Richard Lentz. My wife is raised not too far from here, down in the southern part of Missouri. Long and tragic story, but raised in Manhattan for the first 10 years of her life, and our family broke apart under really difficult circumstances when she was 12 years old and went from Midtown Manhattan to a little farming village in southern Missouri to live with her grandfather. Safety was a place where there were lots of trees, not lots of tall buildings. When I met her, and shortly thereafter, proposed, one of my first trips was to meet the tribe, meet the clan, to journey down to Crane, Missouri. And they were there waiting for the stranger. I don't know how many there were. I couldn't count that day, but I was ushered into the farmhouse and told to sit on the couch. By Granny. And Granny then told everybody else they could leave. I was a little bit nervous. I wasn't sure what was coming. And sure enough, everybody obeyed. They departed. And I sat there, and Granny then investigated. Where had I come from? So I told her, Pittsburgh. And she said, and your parents, where did they come from? And their parents, where did they come from? I got to about the third generation, and I didn't know. She was stunned. 88 years old, frail and fragile. She couldn't believe I couldn't narrate my own history. She wanted to know what I was going to do. I was a young and very poor graduate student with a minimal chance of finding a job in the present job market. That didn't exactly warm her sense of my well-being. She wanted to know, had my father also taught? Well, no, he had been in business. Well, had there been anybody else in your family who wanted to do what you're doing? Not that I knew of. Again, this was absolutely stunning that my vocation was entirely disconnected with anything in my past. She then said, now you can begin. And by it she meant, you can ask me where I came from. And so gently I did. And I was shocked about how much she understood about our own history. And she regaled me for several hours. I remember as if it happened yesterday, it was 30 years ago, of all the interesting characters in Kentucky and in Wisconsin, and then in Missouri, that her great, great, great grandparents had known. And she told this marvelous story. And there was this overwhelming sense in me that day of how strange her world was by comparison to mine. She knew where she had come from. I was adrift in this sea, having no sense of where I had come from, and only deep ambiguity as to where I was going. It seems to me that the scriptures give us this great story of where we've come from. Far before 9/11 or Vietnam or the Civil War, right? These great climactic events which often shape whole cultures are but stories interpreted by this great epic drama that began with God speaking the world into being and closes with those great climactic words, it is finished. We're going to get there. Thinking about Luke 24 and the story in the road to Emmaus and those wonderful two disciples, Cleopas, the other, whose name we do not know. And they ask Jesus when he shows up unannounced after the resurrection and ask them, why are you so sad? They're incredulous. Don't you know we were following this Messiah and he died? He up and died on us and we thought he was the one. There is no better evidence that he was a false Messiah. Messiah, the Messiah, Israel's Messiah, doesn't die. Jesus asked a little bit more. What were you hoping he was going to do? Reading a little bit between the lines, get rid of those Gentiles. Restore Israel to its former glory. Return the temple so that we had full access. Recover David's city. They were hoping that the past could be returned to them. Jesus then says, let me tell you a story. And you almost get mad at Luke at this point. Because he doesn't tell us many details of that story, but he does say that beginning with the law and the prophets, I suspect he started in Genesis. And I don't know how long the sermon was, but he got all the way to the end of Malachi. And he said, that story, that's about me. Everything, it's about me. They were stunned. Still, they don't see Jesus until they break bread with him. And then their eyes are opened. Luke pays a lot of attention to eyes. It'd be really interesting to do a whole biblical theology of eyes. I'll do a little bit in a moment, but their eyes are open, and then Jesus is gone. Not what you'd expect, but they understand now because they see that the whole story finds its locus in Jesus. That the narrative of the Old Testament from Adam and Eve to Abraham, to Moses, to Samson, to Job, to David. I mean, how long was that story that Jesus told that day? They were all about him. They all pointed to Jesus. If you had eyes to see. If you had a theological vision. Keller calls this the middleware. A way to see the world by virtue of the map you're using. The linkage between the software and the hardware. I don't know enough technology to be able to spell that out much, but I get it. That there's got to be an operating system by which the software connects with the hardware and vice versa. It makes sense of the whole. Our vision, language I'd rather use, is like a pair of glasses that allows you to see things more clearly. Right? And that the scriptures give us that vision. They give us eyes to see. Though often, as the prophets remind us, we have eyes but don't see. Ears but don't hear. That sensory malfunctioning of our perceptual capacity that comes with idolatry, right out of Exodus 32. They become like the object they've worshipped. That golden calf has eyes, but cannot see. It has ears, but it cannot hear. It has a stiff neck. It has a hard heart. And from that point forward, the prophets often refer to Israel using the same language. Just picking up a little bit on this language of a vision, of eyes, of seeing. Think about David and Goliath. These great stories of the Old Testament often pay particular attention to ears or to eyes. David shows up, you know the story, you've preached on it 1,000 times probably. Shows up and he sees Goliath. His compatriots, his brothers as well as the rest of the Israel army, looks at this Philistine and see terror. I mean, how tall is he? How big's this spear he's got in his hand? How big is the breastplate? Who could possibly stand in his way? What do they see? They see they haven't got a chance. Saul is time and again trying to compel somebody to go fight Goliath, but nobody wisely takes up the challenge. They haven't got a chance. David, what does David see? That text draws our attention to the reality that Goliath is only 10 feet tall. I mean, he's only got a spear, folks, and a breastplate. And he's going up against the living God? Are you serious? Right? David sees something very different than the rest of the Israelites. They see the same thing and see it very differently. This vision of thinking about our world, our culture, is thinking about Goliath. What do we see? Quickly, if theology is a way to narrate the great story of history, rooted in the great realities of who God is, a map on the basis of which we are given a different set of eyes to see our world, how should we think about this world? Carefully. Any attempt to think about culture simplistically is as hopeless as thinking about the Trinity in simplistic fashion. You know, it's one of those words which we use all the time thinking we actually understand it with a great deal of precision. In reality, it refers to anything remotely connected to anything. It can mean everything and nothing. So, new begin. Culture. Culture is the sum total of ways of living developed by a group of human beings handed on from generation to generation. Central to culture is language, the words a people use. The language provides the means by which they express their way of perceiving things, their vision. And around that center, one has to group the visual, the musical arts, the technologies, the laws, the political organizations. Also, one must include in culture a set of beliefs, experiences, and practices that grasp the ultimate nature of things. Culture is the air that we breathe. It is everything. It is not merely the world out there. It encompasses the way we think about the world out there, the language we use about that world, the way we live in it, and how we experience it. It's a conversation, to use a metaphor, with lots of different voices in the conversation. You're at a party, a loud party, in someone's home, and the echoes are reverberating in your ears. There are lots of conversations going on, probably only one or two of which you're part of. But those others kind of intrude as background noise, and occasionally you enter into the conversations elsewhere. And maybe by the end of the evening, you've circulated among a variety of conversations. What have you heard? I guarantee you it's not the same thing your spouse heard that evening, because she has a different set of ears. He has heard something different. Right? Culture is a great big party in that sense, with lots of conversations going on around us. And in that conversation, you also have a voice and a set of ears that hear things in peculiar ways and speak into it. You know, sometimes when I'm lecturing, I have that out-of-body experience. You do it when you preach on occasion, don't you? You're kind of thinking, now what am I going to say? Oh yeah, that's what... And you almost begin to talk to yourself, as if there is this internal conversation going on between you and you. there are two things having this conversation. That is to say, your engagement with the voices around you is a peculiar engagement. And of course, then God is also part of the conversation, although we don't recognize his voice too often, though it's our hope that we're not the only ones speaking. In an earlier time, those voices seemed more simple. There weren't so many of them. The conversations were more intimate, or so they seemed. They were oriented around family and kinship. There weren't 1,000 different political voices, but one, mostly. The conversation seemed somewhat homogeneous. That's how a late modern or a high modern or a postmodern or you and I would think about earlier times. Ours is a time of radical social pluralism, the exponential increase of voices that surround us is something that is almost overwhelming to us now. We live in a time where democratic consumerism is not simply an ideology. It's a lived reality which focuses on you. You get to vote. You get to buy. And often you get to buy your vote in a time like ours. We live in an economic environment and a political environment which privileges the individual with great benefit. I'm glad I didn't live in Stalin's Russia, right? Or Napoleon's France. I'm glad I get to vote, if not always my vote matters. Tyranny is not all it's cracked up to be. Ever was cracked up to be something. And consumerism, think about everything you can buy. In fact, can you think of anything you haven't bought? You buy clean air, clean water, you buy food, you buy houses, you buy your clothes, you buy your education, you buy your church. On the list goes. It's Peter Berger's point. Everything we experience is a consumer transaction today. Everything. We live also in the age of high technology. Although I suspect in 5 years we'll look back on the 2014s, or whatever they might be called, as kind of passé. We're in the fourth industrial revolution by most historians' account, and it greatly impacts the way we experience life. We experience it vicariously with our smart machines. Though everybody knows that those little machines run your life, even if they also make it more efficient. The tyranny of technology is by now an obvious reality. How many emails are going to be in your inbox on Saturday morning when you get back from this conference? I did an experiment last year with my class. I told them when they come to class to leave their smartphones in their dorms or their apartments, and do not bring a computer. We're actually going to have a conversation. There was nervousness those first couple of sessions. It was as if the security blanket had been ripped out. It was good, and people are still human, they still have conversations face to face. But it reminded all of us of how deeply connected our lives are to our technologies. Our technologies organize our lives. We speak of relationships as networking or interfacing or connecting. I haven't seen it, though I will shortly, I think, the movie Her. A movie about a young single man who falls in love with a voice on his smartphone. And it's played out from there, not simply as a fantasy. For the voice on his smartphone is much more convenient than talking to a real person, and mostly says what she's programmed to say. And doesn't get angry at him, doesn't get impatient, is almost more human than he is, or so he comes to believe. And our relationships are largely arbitrary and impersonal. James Hunter has reminded us that culture making is limited to a very small number of us in the elite cities of the West. The density of these elite communities is where cultures are changed. His point largely and somewhat acerbically is we evangelicals ought to give up the hope that we can change culture. That mythology that we embraced in the post-60s era is simply that, a mythology. And religion, where is religion in the modern or late modern or high modern or postmodern world? It is sequestered, as it is at Logan Airport in Boston, situated between Terminal D and Terminal E, on a corridor that you'd never go through unless you were lost. There is a chapel there, the Chapel of the Airways. It's ecumenical. There's actually a priest assigned to the chapel at Logan Airport. Could you imagine a more desolate, more barren mission field than ministering at the big airport? Evidently, there are actually weddings that take place there, funerals occasionally. I've gone there on investigative journeys, but I can't imagine the great missionaries that went to Burma or India or China in the 19th century met as unpromising a mission field as trying to be a presence at the airport. But of course, that's part of the world we live in. That is our world. We are sequestered. And we're going to take a moment for a break. But I'm reminded of great social analyst Peter Berger, and then after him, actually Harvey Cox, think about modern life as a big airport, where all of life is programmed to be efficient. Numbers, flight 413 on Terminal 3 at Gate 42, is all the language you need to know. And you don't really want to talk to anybody at the airport. It's an unpleasant experience in good times. You want to get it over with. And yet there is this mythology. You see these massive metal birds taking off into the sky with hundreds of people on them to far-off destinations. And we suppose that's where we want to go. How are we as evangelicals to think at the airport, but not obviously simply at the airport? After the break, I want to ask simply, how are we to understand these two stories, these two maps, these two worlds, the two frameworks, and how do we get eyes to see? After break.